The following special program is transcribed.
To every American, George Gershwin's music has a particular personal meaning. He was our great folk musician. He caught his inspiration from our energy, our nervousness, our imagination, our youth, and our strength. His musical personality was forceful enough to raise the level of taste that existed before him.
This is Biography in Sound. Our subject tonight, the serious George Gershwin. Our host, the famous music composer and motion picture producer, Arthur Schwartz. Also to tell you about George Gershwin as they knew him will be Irving Berlin, Paul Whiteman, Irving Caesar, Fred Astaire, Todd Duncan, and Ira Gershwin. Now, here is Arthur Schwartz.
I had wanted to meet George Gershwin long before I finally managed to. For years, he was pouring delicious melodies into Broadway scores while I was skipping college classes to try my luck at the unyielding keys of the recreation hall piano. These frustrating attempts at composition would frequently end with an angry abandonment of my own futile search and a fierce pianistic switch to the latest Gershwin gems, which I would play with easily as much envy as admiration. By the time I did get acquainted with George in 1925... he was an international figure, and I was a practicing lawyer with furtive musical hopes. We became friends. I was eager to learn all about his childhood and early musical development. It was fascinating. As Ira Gershwin, his brother, recalls,
we were four children. I was the oldest and was born in Manhattan. 20 months later, George was born in Brooklyn. Then came brother Arthur, and finally the youngest, my sister Frances. We never stayed in one location very long, and I counted that up to 1916, we had lived in 28 different places, most of them in Manhattan. We were living in an apartment on 2nd Avenue and 7th Street around 1910, when my parents felt they could afford to buy an upright piano on which I was to take lessons. My Aunt Kate played the piano somewhat, and she had given me some lessons, which had brought me up to page 32 of Byers' Exercises. So naturally, when our own piano was hoisted through the window into the front room, it was expected that I was the one who'd continue taking lessons, but this time under a regular teacher. No sooner was the precise location for the piano decided on and the piano stool placed before it than George sat down and twirled away quite professionally, rhythmically and harmonically, on a popular song of the day. We then discovered that for several months he had been fooling around the piano keys at a friend's house down the block. I had never been an apt pupil anyway, so I backed up George in his plea that he, rather than I, be given piano lessons. But no matter with whom or what branch of music he studied, he somehow always retained his own distinctive style.
In the later years of his life, George Gershwin gave no evidence of great emotional conflicts. But in the formative period of his early teens, he surely must have suffered. Moved as he was by having the doors opened to the great library of classical music, he nevertheless couldn't stop improvising earthy melodic phrases of his own, contemporaneous beats and cadences that he knew could find expression only in popular songs. So it was he sought out a conservatory which could teach him what he wanted to know, Tin Pan Alley.
Thank you.
While George Gershwin worked as a song plugger, he was also learning his trade. He played what the hack composers turned out, and he played what the good ones did. And he learned the good from the bad. And all the time he was writing his own music. Even then, the King of Tin Pan Alley was Irving Berlin. George wanted more than anything else to play his songs for Berlin.
I first met George Gershwin in 1919. And I am now looking at a song that I wrote when I came out of the army that George Gershwin transcribed or took down for me because I can't write music at the offices of T.D. Harms because I then was thinking of going with Max Dreyfus, his publisher. The song, it may interest you to know that the song was interpolated in a show called The Royal Vagabond, produced by Conan Harris. And it was called The Revolutionary Rag. It was a kidding song about the Russian Revolution with words like the slicky, sticky, Bolsheviki, and things like that. But anyhow, George took it down, and he played it so that I just didn't recognize it. It was so beautiful, you see. And I was impressed by this great pianist. And I asked him what he was doing. He said he was trying to write. I said, well, have you written anything? He said, yes. I've written some songs, and he played me some wonderful songs, which later became part of a very successful score called La La Lucille. And he said, why don't you, you're going in business now here, why don't you let me go to work for you and take down your tunes and be your accompanist. And after listening to his music, I said, George, don't you go to work for anyone else. You write your own.
In 1919, George Gershwin met another musician who was to have a rather important effect on his life, Irving Caesar.
George, in those days, was probably the most interesting pianist of his kind in America, considering that he hadn't really begun to tutor, to coach, and to study. He had study in back of his mind. And as you all know, he later took music very seriously and learned why he was doing the things he had been doing instinctively. He was sort of a child prodigy, I'd say. One day, there's so many stories about Gershwin. One day, we were around Harms, and Harms had published a song that was sweeping the country called Hindustan. You remember Hindustan, where I came to rest my tired caravan. It was a one-step. And we must have had a little money then. We must have had a little success because I remember saying to George, I said, let's go to Moore's tonight. That was a very famous and still is a very famous chop house. And let's have a good dinner and let's go home to your house and write a one-step to take the place of Hindustan when Hindustan has faded out. We discussed it on a Fifth Avenue bus. We laid out our strategy just as though we were going to take a hill in a wall. We said we'll make this a one-step, we'll make it an American one-step, and we'll call it Swanee. And we went up to his house and got over to the piano. I remember the precise time. It was about 9:30 in the evening, and there was a little card game going on. His family liked to play cards in a very social way, of course. And the dining room where the card game was going on was divided from the little piano alcove by the inevitable beaded curtain in those days. It was always a beaded curtain. And that was our little cell. And we wrote Swanee in about 12 or 15 minutes. It was just an inspiration. And we were very happy about the thing. And George's father, who was a very cute little man, I remember ran and got a comb and put some tissue paper on it and insisted on accompanying us. He was going to show us that it would make a great band number. And the poor fellows who were losing in the game wanted us to stop writing. He said, boys, you'll finish it some other time. And the fellows who were winning in the game said, oh, no, let them finish it. It's very good. Let the boys work. They feel like working. Let them work.
Gershwin had produced his first great hit. It was not his greatest song, and he knew it. But it had done a marvelous thing for him. Now he was free to compose. Today, it may seem surprising that The Man I Love, Liza, and Fascinating Rhythm were thought of as extremely sophisticated songs when first heard. If they are now part of the language, so to speak, we must remember that the boundaries of the language were stretched the moment Gershwin appeared on the scene. He once said, "I hate the obvious." He proved it in every frame. Just as Gershwin was to find his inspiration for his work in his home country, it was in his own home that he found one of the happiest associations ever known between two brothers. A tune, of course, is not a song. To be sung, it must have words. George was lucky to find his ideal collaborator right in the family. Throughout their prolific partnership, his brother Ira invented lyrics to match the wit and warmth of the music. This was a truly phenomenal feat when one considers that nearly always the tunes were written first, and Ira was required to be brilliant within the most confining rhythms and accents. It was a little like flying in a straitjacket, but he managed it.
"Waiting for the Sun to Come Out" was our first published song. We did this for the Sweetheart Shop in 1920. By then, I had adopted the pseudonym Arthur Francis, combining the given names of my brother Arthur and my sister Francis. Because even at that time, George is quite a celebrity to me, and I didn't want to trade on his name. Incidentally, I was Arthur Francis until 1924. That year, beginning with Primrose, a London show, and Lady Be Good in New York, I began using my own name. There isn't time to tell the technique, the time element, the joys, and the impedimenta of collaboration. For each song, each opening, each finale was a problem or challenge to be solved or faced its own way. Generally, however, in my case, the music did come first. But George was his distinctive self, whether the music came first or he had to set music to a lyric.
Just as Gershwin was opening new horizons in the composition of jazz music, another talented young man was attracting astonishing attention for his presentation of jazz. It was therefore inevitable that the paths of George Gershwin and Paul Whiteman should cross.
You see, I had been a great admirer of George Gershwin because he was one of the few fellows on Tin Pan Alley that played really great piano. That either went for popular or any of the lighter classics. He could have been a real great concert pianist. And I think that probably his love for writing was the thing that stopped it. And George and I had discussed for a long time about a concert, a jazz concert. We felt that, just maybe once a year, that it would be all right to let down everybody's hair a little bit and have a jazz concert in amongst the regular concert series. And he had been trained, as I say, to be a concert pianist, and I had been in the symphonies for a great many years. I was the principal viola in a couple of the larger symphonies. And I felt the same way that, in fact, I guess you could sum it up best by saying that I felt that jazz wasn't as bad as the symphonic fellows thought it was, and I didn't think that the symphonic music was half as bad as the jazz fellows thought it was. And I thought on a common ground we might possibly meet. Well, we talked about this ideal jazz concert for a long while, and it settled on a title, which it would be The Rhapsody in Blue. And we chose Rhapsody because Rhapsody in symphonic work means free form. You don't have to do as in symphonies, recapitulate each movement and put them all together, and it would give you a lot of freedom to write. Well, I had a manager at the time, was a very cagey guy, and I guess he'd come up from Lindy's or one of the joints, and he said, "Do you know that a competitor of yours is going to give a jazz concert after you've been talking about it these 2 years?" Well, I said, "That was always one of my faults. I'm a little gabby. So I'll stop that right away." So I picked up the phone and shopped around for a hall, and I settled on Aeolian Hall, and the only date they had was Lincoln's birthday, and that was in 1924. So I said, "Well, I'll take the hall." I didn't have anything to play, but I took the hall. And I announced to all the papers that I was going to give a jazz concert. Well, George called me up about 6 o'clock in the morning. He says, "What is this I read in the papers, that you're going to give a jazz concert and I'm writing the important work, The Rhapsody in Blue?" I says, "That's right." And he said, "Well, you're going to do it in 2 weeks. I says, "That's right." "Oh," he says, "man, it would take me at least 6 months to gather thematic material for a big work like that." I said, "Well, you get out of the symphony, put your hair back up, and get ready and start writing, because hot or cold, the body goes out on February 12, 1924. Well, George wrote The Rhapsody in Blue. He would give it to us page by page, and each day we'd get a page or two, and Ferdy Grofe would orchestrate it. A band would rehearse it that night after we got through at the Palais Royal, and by the time he wrote the last note, we had it all perfectly rehearsed. And, of course, the success of The Rhapsody in Blue is past history, and I can only say that I'm always, and always will be, a very grateful guy to a fellow by the name of George Gershwin.
Rhapsody in Blue made Gershwin an international celebrity. He took another giant step forward when Walter Damrosch commissioned him to write a concerto for his New York Symphony Society Orchestra. It has been said that when George accepted this commission, the first thing he did was to go out and buy a textbook to find out exactly what a concerto was. On December the 3rd, 1925, in Carnegie Hall, it was clear that he had not only found out what a concerto was, he had written a brilliant one.
Thank you.
You are listening to Biography in Sound. Part two will continue after a 10-second pause for station identification. The Serious George Gershwin. Part two. Tonight's Biography in Sound.
In 1928, Gershwin went abroad. He was not a temperamental man, but the pressure of social obligations and all the distractions of being the fair-haired boy of the music world at the moment had begun to rob him of the time he needed for his work. While abroad, a new concert work, An American in Paris, was completed. Before its public hearing, I heard George play a piano version at his home one evening. It was on that occasion that I recall feeling as never before that there were absolutely no limits to his talent and skill. In this music, I actually saw a picture of real people in a real locale, breathing, walking, dancing, and longing. About 1930, George Gershwin read a novel which fascinated him by its tremendous dramatic possibilities. He thought in terms of an opera, but felt technically unready to attempt such a project. Finally, though, in 1933, he embarked on the greatest adventure of his career, the making of America's greatest folk opera, Porgy and Bess. While working on Porgy and Bess, George turned down lucrative songwriting and performing contracts. He moved out of his sumptuous New York apartment, rented a waterfront cabin near Charleston, and started to drink in the physical and musical atmosphere of Catfish Row. These bewitching sights and sounds became the source material for the first great American folk opera. After almost a year of composition and 9 months of orchestration, Gershwin produced the work which was to assure for him the grand prize he wanted so much, immortality.
I had the pleasure and privilege of knowing George Gershwin very well, for he coached me on every single note and word of his beloved opera, Porgy and Bess.
The original Porgy, Todd Duncan.
I say beloved because he loved every single bar, every page, and every melody in the entire score. However, two incidents stand out in my memory of this man. And the first in 1934, the spring of 1934, when he and Ira played and sang the entire score for the directors of the Theater Guild. It was the first full hearing for me, too. So we listened to George and Ira all afternoon while they performed in George's studio, which was the upper room of his penthouse. He sang and played caressingly every note and every line. And when he got to the second act, he turned to me and winked and said, "Todd, this song is going to make you famous." Well, naturally, I sort of perked up, only to hear sort of a simple banjo clink, clank, clink, clank, clink, clank. Well, I was mortified, really horrified. To confess, I must tell you that I was something of a musical stuffed shirt, and I considered the thing really impossible. What amazes me now is that the man's mind and intuition, if not his prophecy, are something close to a miracle. For in fact, in these 20 years, I've sung that song, Plenty of Nothing, thousands of times, and pretty much all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, the music critics received Porgy and Bess with a great lack of perception. Many people in the audience were puzzled and startled by it, and Gershwin was denied the public acclaim he had earned. He went off to Hollywood and began working on the score for Shall We Dance? The stars were Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
When George came to Hollywood to do Shall We Dance for Ginger and me, it was, of course, an exciting experience, inasmuch as both Ginger and I had done at separate times stage shows with him in New York. My first meeting with George was when he was at the Jerome H. Remick and Company Music Publishers in about 1915. He was a pianist with that organization, demonstrating the company's product to those who, like myself, used to drop in search of material for their vaudeville acts, such as my sister Adele and I had. We used to discuss with George in those days how we'd love to be in a musical comedy, and then he'd say, well, that was his ambition, too, to write a musical show. At that point, he'd never done one. He said one day, wouldn't it be great if I could write the music for a show for you, too, and so forth and so forth. A few years later, my sister and I were in a show called Apple Blossoms, music by Fritz Kreisler and Victor Jacobi. During rehearsals of that show, George came over several times to play piano for rehearsals during the absence of the regular pianist. We again talked and joked about the day he'd write a show for us. Well, several years later, George did write the score for Lady Be Good for us and then Funny Face. Of course, by this time, George had done many, many famous things. It was a great privilege to have sort of started out with George. At the same time, working with him was also a rare treat. He had a terrific sense of humor and would often get up from the piano to demonstrate his idea for a dance step, which, of course, I got a big kick out of.
Early in 1937, sometime in the spring, while working on the score of a screen musical, The Goldwyn Follies, George Gershwin suffered a collapse. He recovered, but on Saturday, the 10th of July, 1937, he collapsed a second time. In a coma, he was rushed to the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital in Hollywood.
We were working on The Goldwyn Follies when George began to get the headaches, which 3 weeks later proved to be caused by a tumor in the brain.
Ira Gershwin.
He never learned during that period that he had just been elected an honorary member of the Academy of Santa Cecilia, Rome, Italy's highest award to foreign composers. We didn't bother him with correspondence, although 2 days before the operation, we were still discussing songs. He died Sunday morning, July 11th, 1937, in Los Angeles at the age of 38.
If George Gershwin was not properly estimated in his lifetime, he was soon after he died. The 20 years since Porgy and Bess was composed, it has become the most performed, the best loved native opera. The Department of State sent it touring all over the world as the finest example of our musical culture. Audiences everywhere were ecstatic. Early in 1955, it was welcomed at La Scala in Milan, birthplace of Verdi's and Puccini's masterpieces. No other work by an American-born composer had ever been presented there. Gershwin's position today as the greatest American composer of this century will not easily be challenged. Music lovers the world over speak his name with tenderness, as if he had been a dear friend. For a long time, my own feelings about his loss seemed too complex to be expressed. But recently I came across something written by John O'Hara that says it all. George Gershwin died on July 11th, 1937. But I don't have to believe it if I don't want to.
have been listening to the biography in sound of George Gershwin.